The Trust for Sustainable Living presents Speaking of Sustainability, a podcast about the environment and the issues our planet faces. Today we'll be talking to Matthew Simpson as part of our mini-series on green jobs. Today's episode is hosted by Kirsty Shakespeare.
As their director, Matthew has over 20 years' experience delivering nature conservation, research, assessment and management-related projects. He's currently president of the Society of Wetland Scientists, Europe chapter, past president of the Society of Wetland Scientists Professional Certification Programme, and is a long-standing member of the Constructed Wetlands Association Committee. He also sits on the Ramsar Convention on Wetlands Scientific and Technical Review Panel and their Wetland City Accreditation Independent Advisory Committee. Matthew has managed projects in Europe, Asia, Southeast Asia, Africa, South America, and North America. Matthew holds a BSc Honours degree in Geography and Geology, a Master's in Environmental Water Management, and a PhD in Geography.
Welcome, Matthew, to the podcast. Thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
So I'd love it if you could start by introducing yourself and telling us a bit about your background work and how it relates to sustainability and what motivated you to do it, if you could.
Okay, so yeah, I'm Matthew Simpson and I wear a number of different hats. So I used to work for the Wildfowl and Wetlands Trust, which is a conservation NGO. And I was one of the directors of their consultancy there, and that's working mainly in kind of wetland area. And 3 years ago, myself and another director, Rebecca Woodward, set up our company 35%. And we specialise in wetlands, really, and working with governments, but also with landowners, with private individuals to kind of manage wetlands, but in a more sustainable way. So I'll talk about that a little bit more later. And also I work for, set up an organisation called the Cobra Collective, and that works with marginalised communities, well, all communities around the world. We started working with Amerindian communities in South America mainly, and really looking at sustainable solutions for them to face the challenges, such as environmental challenges and social and economic challenges that they face. And really, it's about empowering communities. So it's identifying community best practices that are already being undertaken by communities and then sharing those with other communities. And the key thing there is really looking at whether it's socially just and fair and sustainable on a social level, but also on an environmental level. And so those solutions are then promoted, and we use a technique called participatory video, and that helps with communities that don't have literacy or high literacy, but it's a way of communicating those best practices. So with very simple training now, with kind of mobile phones or tablets, people can learn to document these best practices and then share those with other people. So we do a lot of work like that. And we also, as well as sort of kind of on the practical level, we also work with governments doing policy and strategy support as well. So it's very much, it can be working with a local school or a local community, but it also can be working with governments or intergovernmental organisations. So we do a whole range of things. So in terms of my background, how I got into it, I've always liked massively into nature. And that was a thing that was developed from when I was a child. And so I wanted to do something around that. And I ended up doing a geography degree. And well, it was geography and geology. But I really liked the water element of it. I was interested in water. And so I then went on to do an environmental water management master's degree. And then that even got more specialist into wetlands and water and wetlands. And I did a PhD eventually in wetlands. But the key thing, I think, and particularly, which is probably slightly different on the sustainability question, is my career has really taken a path which has looked at kind of landscape and landscape units and how they work. So particularly thinking about how water works within the landscape and separating that up and thinking about what it does for us. So in terms of wetlands, for example, they are very good at treating pollution. They're very, very good at providing water. They're essential for providing food in many parts of the world. That might be rice cultivation, which feeds, you know, massive proportion of the global population, or it might be, like here in the UK, farmers grazing animals on a floodplain, for example. So wetlands provide all these benefits, but different parts of those wetlands are particularly good at doing that. And that's what my kind of research in my PhD was, to look at how the landscape functions and thinking about how that helps people, but also helps the environment. So, yeah.
Fantastic. Thank you. It does, definitely. Yeah. And I wonder, for those listeners that aren't aware, can you perhaps tell us some of the benefits and the importance of wetlands? Because they're often quite an overlooked ecosystem, aren't they?
They really are. And there's been some big global developments recently, which, you know, perhaps I could talk about later. But yeah, they were kind of traditionally seen as kind of wastelands, I think, a bit. And people have spent a lot of time over history trying to drain them and separate water from them, so channelizing rivers so that the water couldn't get out. But I think it's becoming more accepted now how important they are on a range of ecosystem services and benefits for people. And yeah, they're one of the key ecosystems. And I mean, just out of interest, they hold about 40% of biodiversity. So they're important on a kind of a nature biodiversity, which is like the basis of all life. So that's important. But yeah, they keep water clean. They provide clean water, they provide food, they're a very important carbon store. So if we're thinking about, you know, particularly the peatlands around the world, they're incredibly important for storing carbon. But they also, which does really get overlooked, they're an important sort of cultural and social resource for people. Many cultures have always, you know, sort of associated with water and wetlands. And, you know, a lot of kind of, if you look at religious or cultural aspects, they're very linked to water. And so it has a really core part of our identity, as well as providing all of these benefits. So I think the level of importance was shown because in early 1970s, the Ramsar Convention on Wetlands was signed by a number of countries, and now I think it has 172 signatories. And it's the only ecosystem that has an intergovernmental treaty convention. And so it's shown that it's important. But I think probably, you know, over my career, only in the last like 10 years, I'd say it's got into the public perception of how important they are. And things like flooding is a massive issue for lots of communities, and people are realizing that we can't just build concrete defenses. We actually have to go further up the river catchments and allow the rivers to go back into their floodplains and water to be stored within the catchments so that it doesn't impact towns and cities downstream. And I think then people are thinking, oh yeah, wetlands are important for those reasons. But on the projects we do, so we work with people to actually kind of design wetlands, restore wetlands. So we go out and we do soil surveys, hydrology surveys, ecological surveys. We work with communities and stakeholders to understand what they want. And it's really important, I think, to have this like a holistic view of a wetland and not just think of it as a, I don't know, a physical functioning thing, but think of it of how it works with people. Are people wanting to get a livelihood out of it? Do they want to use it as a recreation resource? And then when you do the designs, you can build that all in. So we then, you know, do designs on that basis and then, you know, supervise the construction of it so that it provides these kind of additional benefits. So I'm very resistant against people that have a single focus for a project because it tends to exclude a lot of opportunities. So, you know, sometimes it's just for flooding or for water quality improvement, for example, but you're kind of missing opportunities to get a local school involved in education, for example, or get local landowner involved in getting another income from, you know, that restoration project. So it's really key to think, you know, and think when we're thinking about sustainability, as I say, it's really the social side as well as the environmental side and bringing that all together.
Yeah, I think you summed up really well there the value and importance of engaging with all of those different stakeholders and not looking at it as a single use function, and the value of involving governments and local communities and children and all the different people that are going to be utilising or going to be impacted by the wetlands that are being you know, restored or that are being damaged or being impacted anyway. So thank you for explaining that so eloquently. So you mentioned young people working with schools. So what do you think are the ways that young people can influence your work, or have young people influence the work you've been doing?
They're fundamental. I mean, there's always different groups, particularly when you're working with communities. It's very easy when you go and do stakeholder consultation just to listen to the loudest speakers. And they tend to be, well, in my case, white men, to be honest. But what we try and do, we use a lot of different facilitation techniques. And one of those, as I mentioned earlier, was participatory video, where you try and engage with a whole range of people. And the youth and young people's voices are incredibly important in that. And I'll just give you an example of a project that we did in Suriname. And this community had basically been cut off because the bridge across the river into this village, this is an Amerindian community in the tropical rainforest wetlands areas around, they'd been cut off because their bridge had been washed away. And they were waiting for the government to come and mend this bridge. And it had been years. And we were working with this community. We were taking examples from other communities via video to this community. And particularly the young people were very engaged in making videos about what they did well in their community. But one video that came from Guyana, so a country in South America right next to Suriname, was essentially self-help. So the Amerindian communities every week would come together and they would do something together to make their environment or build something or mend something or even just clear up litter or whatever, but they would do it as a community together. And this community in Suriname had not been carried on practicing this. And the young people that were making the videos in Suriname, they very rarely had a voice in the community because it was normally the elders that made the decisions. But through this process, they challenged the elders to make a difference and not wait for the government to come and mend this bridge. They wanted the community to do it. So the young people organized a gathering every week where they would attempt to do this. And after, I think it was a month and a half, they'd rebuilt the bridge by doing it, by coming together as a community. And that you can really see the power of a community coming together, but that was led by young people challenging the elders to do something a bit differently. So yeah, it's a really good example. And in everything we do, we always make sure we engage with a wide range of participants across communities and give them a voice. That's really important because quite often in decision-making, young people, women perhaps, different ethnic communities do not have a voice, and using techniques like participatory video is a really good way to make sure you hear everyone's voices.
It's great that you're working to make sure that inclusion and empowerment are a part of all the projects that you're working, because you say there's so many underrepresented voices that aren't heard at the table and perhaps are some of the most important voices, especially when we think about young people being the ones that are inheriting the mess that we're making or that we've created, and are the ones that are sometimes most active in trying to, you know, put forward those solutions. And if we're not listening to those voices, as you say, we can be missing a lot of, you know, a lot of action, a lot of solutions, and a lot of enthusiasm to get the job done, and the positive belief that we can make the difference, which I think a lot of adults seem to have lost and say it's too late and we can't do it. And the young people are really giving us the yes we can kind of action.
Exactly. So, and challenging, that's the important thing, I think.
Yeah. So what sort of advice would you have given to your younger self, do you think, to help you get to where you are today?
Yeah, that's a really interesting question, because it was a lot about serendipity and luck, I think, in many ways. So, you know, I talked about how I kind of went through my degree and master's degree, and I was lucky enough to have a family that could support me to do my master's degree in particular. My grandmother funded that. My PhD, I managed to get full funding for. One of the key things about my PhD, which I chose, which I would suggest if people are trying to think about courses they might want to do, is really think about the applied element and the practical element of it. Because my PhD actually was a PhD that was funded at the time by the European Union, but that linked 11 different universities across Europe. So I immediately had this big network of colleagues who I still work with, many of them today. But the PhD wasn't me just going off to investigate some fungus or something. well, there's nothing wrong with investigating fungus, but you know, it had a real applied nature. It was thinking about kind of the practical things in terms of management. And I think it's good to focus on that. And then thinking of that on the practical side is volunteering. It's very hard. Appreciate it's getting harder almost to get a job and break into these sectors. And to give you an example, when I finished my master's degree at the time, this is a long time ago now, but my supervisor said it was taking on average about 3 years for people to get a job within the career they wanted. So that's why I chose to do a PhD, because I thought, well, I might as well do that for 3 years because it's like 3 years of training. But I know my fellow director, Rebecca, for example, she did it through volunteering. So she didn't choose to do a PhD, but she volunteered for a number of different conservation organizations because that's what she was interested in. But I think, yeah, getting into a company or a charity and going along and volunteering, I think that really helps, because also it allows you to really find out what you're interested in. As I said, you know, I got really interested in water and how that works in the environment, and that, you know, I'm a hydrologist by training, I guess, and that was my thing. But if you'd asked me that when I was doing my degree, I wouldn't have been able to tell you. But it was only by, you know, studying certain things and understanding it that it got me in that direction. So yeah, try as many things as you can, see what you're interested in, see what catches your attention. And then when you do, volunteer further in that. You know, it's good to have a degree, you know, master's degree, you know, it really helps. If you want to get into really detailed aspects of it, a PhD, but it isn't like the only solution to go down that route, I don't think. You know, so volunteering and being part of things does help. I mean, I just also want to say one thing, that over my time was sort of working before I had my PhD, I managed a project in Vietnam, and everyone just went to the other people that had PhDs. You know, as in they thought there was this hierarchy that they were the ones leading the project, and they were always very good because they went, oh no, you know, Matthew's leading the project. And, you know, some people would treat you sort of differently because you didn't have a PhD. But I think that has broken down a lot since that time. I don't think it's as necessary. In certain careers, it always probably will be, you know, obviously if you're in academia, it will be. But I think what's more important is your training and your passion and your interest. And if you really find something that you're interested in, then that will take you forward. And sometimes that's through volunteering. Sometimes you can get an internship or a paid internship. But yeah, I'd encourage people to do that as much as possible. One of the key things, and I mean, it probably links a bit to kind of challenges, but really think about transferable skills and kind of a holistic view of what you're doing. Because when I think about, you know, day-to-day managerial skills, project management skills, how to understand managing budgets, you know, they're like fundamental things that help, you know, deliver a project. And they're not things perhaps you think about when you think, oh, I want to do a career in sustainability or ecology or geography or whatever it is. You might not think of those things, but actually they're really important when it comes to delivering projects and doing work. So, and the key thing that a number of my colleagues learned when we first started doing these projects is it isn't just about, you know, conservation and species, or it isn't about, in my case, like hydrology and soils and ecology. It's about people. And so having those communication skills, having those facilitation skills, the skills to be able to consult, they're really important. So, and you can really pick those up through volunteering. You might not do them in your degree. You might not get training in that, but those are the sort of skills that really make a difference and make you kind of an effective person in the workplace or in the, you know, the career that you want to choose. So think of those transferable skills, because I think people don't necessarily concentrate on those, but they're vitally important for your day-to-day work.
I would definitely echo that as well. I worked in retail for a long time while I was doing my college studies and undergraduate, and then I worked in recruitment when I graduated from my master's. So it took me about 2 years to get, you know, that first, you know, degree-related job. And actually, I think I was much more successful in getting that job because I had the transferable skills that I gained in communications, customer service, office administration that I've got through the non-degree related work. So as frustrating as it was to not be doing what I wanted to do at the time, actually those skills and the experience that I gained from those other roles were really helpful in me getting my, you know, first degree related job. So I think that's really important to echo, and it's never too late to transfer or move those skills across to a different industry, because a lot of them are so transferable and important, as you say. I wonder as well if you mentioned that you work a lot with communities, and sometimes perhaps an important skill by experts in all fields is perhaps recognizing that you may not always be the most expert, and perhaps there's other people that don't have the degrees or don't have the background but that have the local community knowledge or really live in these areas and understand that you have to almost bow down and respect the knowledge that they're able to bring to projects as well.
Yeah, that's a really, I'm glad you brought that up, and I'm sorry I haven't mentioned it previously, because it's key, because everything we do is we try not to be top down in our approach. More recently, we've been working kind of with a rights of nature approach, which comes from Indigenous communities and their belief systems, particularly. And I think you have to really always approach any project, any interaction with humility. And, you know, I am constantly learning on everything. And it's really good to sort of have that mindset and understand, you know, particularly if you come from like maybe a more science background, that science is only one way of approaching a problem, and it's really important and it's good to understand it. But actually, other people's approaches and belief systems are really key. And that's not just in working with Amerindian communities in the rainforest in South America, for example. That's also working with local farmers just down the road from me here. So you have to understand what their motivations are, what their knowledge is, what's their understanding. I mean, just a really simple practical thing is I often have to find out about flooding, and I can measure the soil, I can measure water levels, I can install equipment, I can do all of that, and I can start, you know, measuring where the flood depths and how long it's been flooded. Or I can just go and talk to the local farmer and stand by a tree and say, when it floods, what level does it come up this tree? And when it does come up, how often does it do it, and how long does it stay at that level? And you find you get all of that knowledge and understanding without having to spend thousands of pounds on, you know, studying something. And often, I mean, that's where I think the humility comes from, because we have done studies and it has only really backed up the local community's knowledge in many cases, which then has allowed the government to listen to them. You know, and so science can be very important in that sense, because it, unfortunately, in many parts of the world, governments, even local government and certainly national government, doesn't necessarily listen to the needs of the communities. But if you go and talk to them, understand what their issues are, and then use science to back up their information, then, you know, governments, unfortunately, then, you know, tend to listen a bit better. So, you know, but it's really understanding what communities and the knowledge and the experience there, and bringing that together into a project. And also what it means, you know, sort of after the project finishes, is that then it's really taken on by communities and they take it forward. You know, too often you see like a 2 or 3 year project, something happens and then it falls apart. But if the communities are very much part of the development of it, the delivery of it, then they will normally keep it going afterwards. So it's really key. Always approach things with humility, I would suggest.
Yeah, another really great example of the value of that local stakeholder engagement as well, and getting them to, you know, almost take ownership and continue the project. So it's not a short-term fix. It becomes integrated into the local culture and the local ways. So it benefits everyone longer term as well. Brilliant. Thank you for that. And I wonder if you can share with us some of the particular challenges that you're facing in your work at the moment and any opportunities that you expect to face in the future.
Yeah. So, the main challenge, I mean, the thing that is weighing on my mind is obviously, you know, big things like climate change and biodiversity loss. And yeah, we haven't, you know, I've been working in this for like 25 years and we're still seeing this kind of massive decline. And so I think the big challenge is communicating that to the public and communicating it to decision makers. But from my sort of experience, that's done through positive examples. It's not through necessarily, you know, different types of advocacy where we're, you know, constantly trying to sort of like shout at politicians or whatever. But if you can bring them to a wetland, for example, where the community has been part of it, where it's really been a real success, then they can see the value of it, and then they can change their policies and their understanding towards that. I mean, we have to obviously do lobbying. And, you know, recently we were at the Ramsar Conference of Parties and also the Convention on Biological Diversity Conference of Parties. And amazingly, in the CBD one, they're setting targets. I don't know whether people are aware, but they're setting targets for 2030, where 30% will of the globe will be protected and 30% will be restored of lost ecosystems. But amazingly, they didn't mention wetlands or inland waters, as they call them, within the Convention on Biological Diversity. And so we had to do a lot of lobbying of government and working with the big NGOs like WWF and Wetlands International and others to get that into that text. So there, it's really important to sort of raise that profile, but I think the best way of communicating is showing how it's done, really promoting the voice of communities where it's working really, really well, where, you know, sustainability is a core to what they're doing. And, you know, that's the challenge, I think, is communicating, if you like, the science and the local knowledge to decision makers, to the general public, so that they have a better understanding. And I think it is slowly shifting that way, but we obviously have to do more work. And in terms of opportunities, one, I mentioned it earlier, but the rights of nature approach, I think, is really interesting, because that's giving essentially legal personhood to nature, to a place. So if there's a river or a lake, it's giving legal personhood to it, so that anyone on behalf of that river or lake could take someone else to court if it was being damaged. And it's interesting on a legal perspective, but it's also interesting on a kind of cultural and behavioral perspective. And we're working with communities that already view nature in a very different way. So they're very respectful of it. And they, at their core, are sustainable, because they won't do any activities that have a negative, you know, cycle of impacts. So they will only interact with nature on a sustainable basis. And that, I think, is really interesting. And more countries and more companies are starting to do that. There's some companies in the UK that have nature on their board. So someone represents the voice of nature. And that's really interesting. So I think that is a big opportunity, and that might be of interest to people listening, that there might be something they want to get involved in, because there are lots of, whether you're coming from the legal side or working with community side, there's an opportunity to shift how we think of nature, rather than thinking of it as a resource that we use, thinking of it has a right to exist, and we have to really be sustainable in how we interact with it. So I think that's a big opportunity in the future.
Great. And you mentioned that video participation is one of the ways that you're making your work more inclusive. I wonder if you think technology has really helped to improve the conservation of wetlands, or how it might help in future, these new technological advances we're getting, even in terms of things like social media and the public perception.
I mean, an example of that is, so we're working in Sri Lanka on a project in Colombo, in the capital city, and it's an amazing city because it's got wetlands throughout it. And they're fundamentally important for flood protection in the city. If the city got rid of those wetlands, they'd have a catastrophic flood every year. So it's very well accepted, even by the president, who we've spoken to, about how important wetlands are. But they're still being heavily degraded through pollution and, encroaching and infilling. So in that project, we're working with communities so that they do monitoring of the wetlands, and they're doing that through a mobile app, very simple app that the communities themselves have developed, and they're going out and monitoring basic parameters like, you know, water, color, whether it has an odor or not, what species are still there, flooding, all of these things. But it's really empowering. And that showed how like technology can be very easily used. And there's lots of great kind of environmental apps out there now where people can monitor things. But also linking that to, you know, things such as drones, remote water quality sampling. There's a lot of different technology, satellite, you know, remote sensing is a really big, you know, opportunity. And I think we're only kind of touching the surface there at the moment. I mean, there's really going to be really big developments where it's not, you know, just NASA or, you know, richer countries that have access to that data, but everyone will have access to that data. And it means that communities can directly kind of ground truth that data themselves and feed into it and improve it. So yeah, there's big opportunities there. And I think what's great about it is that I'm hoping polluters and people destroying wetlands won't be able to hide anymore, because through local people using drones or through, you know, interpretation of satellite imagery, people just won't get away with it, because the communities themselves can see what's happening and they can do something about it. So, yeah.
Yeah, great. So citizen science definitely has a place in the future for us.
Yeah, definitely has.
So I wonder if you can tell us about a failure perhaps, or a mistake that you've made during your career that's been turned into a really good learning opportunity for you as well.
Well, I kind of mentioned it before, but I think the biggest one was just focusing on, you know, species and physical parameters. You know, I started off being a real kind of scientist and I was interested in, soils and water and how that all worked. And even when, you know, sort of thinking about it in terms of ecosystem service and benefits, it still was very much people were outside of it. And I worked in organizations which were, you know, nature conservation organizations, but they were really worried about the loss of one species, for example. And that's a massive mistake. And you soon realize, well, I soon realized that actually engaging people and working with people was the key thing. And I'd say probably about 80% of my work is social science now rather than physical science. And yeah, whether it's the lobbying government side or whether it's working with the local farmers, it's really understanding about them and what their needs are. And you have to do it with politicians as you have to do it with the local farmers, because you have to understand what their motivations are, why they're worried that they're not going to get voted in, and, you know, the things that they're concerned about, and you have to give them solutions, you have to help them. So, you know, that was, I think, a massive kind of mistake. And yeah, I was too top down, I have to admit it, to start with. I was going in thinking I had the answer to problems. And I hope I don't do that now. I try and help and try and facilitate. But often you find that communities already know the answers. There's just barriers in their way that you can help as, you know, sort of outsider. Maybe it's through funding, maybe it's through engaging with government that you can support people to change. But that was, yeah, that was a big learning part of my career, I would say.
Yeah, that's a really valuable one as well. I think it highlights the holistic nature of sustainability. And it really does, even though we don't necessarily think about it, integrate into all of our lives in so many different elements. And if you try and look at it in a silo or under a very individual lens, then you lose the value of having the big picture, don't you? So conversely to that, of thinking about failures, what about, would you say there's a particular project or achievement that you're most proud of?
Well, one, this was a long time ago. Well, there's two, actually, if you don't mind.
No, go ahead.
So one was in Nepal, and it was working in a nature reserve near the Indian border. And there's kind of the caste system in that part of Nepal. And so you have very separated community groups. And there was extreme poverty in many of those groups. And there was big environmental pressures on this nature reserve and on the environment in general, because of the kind of population numbers. But again, it wasn't, I can't really claim any credit particularly for it, But we were working with local community representatives that went into different communities and just talked to people and understood what they were doing and what they were doing well. And one thing that people were doing was collecting typha, so bulrush, and they were weaving it into mats. But it was very specifically one community that were doing that. And everyone in that part of the world sleeps on these mats. And someone came into that village, bought the mats from this one little group from the community, and then sold it in northern India and the rest of Nepal. And talking to this community, we said to the people, would you mind sharing your skills with other poorer communities that don't have those skills? And they didn't mind at all. So particularly women, this was, and youth, but it was training them to do how to harvest it, how to dry it, then how to weave it into mats. And the beauty of this was that it was completely sustainable, because it was a wetland product that grew very rapidly. And it didn't mean that they were converting any wetland areas to, I don't know, some more intensive agriculture. And the really interesting thing, and this is where the science bit came, or the economics bit came, is the desire from most people, if they had a little bit of opportunity to grow their own food or get land, they'd convert it to rice. But actually, per unit area, they made less money from rice than they did from harvesting typha. And in terms of the environment, harvesting typha was much better than growing rice. And so through the training that the community did, community, you know, peer-to-peer training, plus us understanding kind of the science and the economics of it, meant that it just made a massive difference to hundreds of families. And it still is doing that. And it's protecting this nature reserve and this environment, because they're not converting parts of it to rice paddy. So, and that's just one example. There were many different livelihoods that were developed there, but that was a huge, huge success. And then very quickly, because I know I'm talking too much, there's a project here in the UK that we did with a community that were worried about flooding in their town, but they had this green space that was run by the council, and the river through this green space had been straightened, so it wasn't flooding out onto the floodplain in normal flood events. It was only doing it in big events and then going into the households, and all the drainage from the town just went directly into the river. So it was highly polluted. It lost a lot of its biodiversity, and it wasn't a great kind of place for the community. But the community sort of started coming together, worked with us and other organizations to develop plans to restore the river, restore the wetlands on the river, use some of the wetlands to treat the water that was coming from the floodplain. But the community was really interesting. We did lots of visioning events. We did lots of concept design and then detailed design actually with the community. So we gave them the physical options, and then they decided where they would be and how they would look. And, you know, we had school children involved. We had, you know, like we went to old people's homes. We had everyone involved in designing these. And unusually, rather than the government signing off the detailed designs, the community signed off the detailed designs. And then they were part of when the construction happened. They came out and they could talk to other members of the community, because they could explain what was happening, because it's always a bit of a mess when you get diggers in and it all starts. And because they were so empowered, they then formed their own group, the management group for the wetland, and then they took management away from the council. So the council handed over management to the community group, and it's now run as this community reserve. They do forest school there, they do all these education programs. And that was just a brilliant project to be part of, because you can see from the very start all the way through, the community were actively involved, and now it's theirs. And, you know, they just run it themselves, and it's brilliant. So, yeah.
Yeah, they both sound like amazing projects to be part of, and I'm not surprised you're proud. And, you know, again, it brings together those elements of the social, economic, well-being and environmental side all being considered and being factored into what's happening. and the plans, and then the communities being involved and being able to take that ownership. So it's not just a short-term project, it becomes part, a real part embedded in the community, which is, you know, I think, as you said, the value of the community stakeholder engagement. So thank you for sharing those with us. That's wonderful. Last couple of questions for you. Have you got a sustainability hero or a role model that inspired you when you were younger to get you into the career that you've gone into today?
Yeah, so there's two actually, again. So my mum particularly, when we were younger, and my gran, I suppose, but they're very much on a very practical, sustainable thing. So there wasn't a lot of waste in our household. There was a lot of reuse of stuff. And also there was a real love of nature. I think I mentioned that before, but you know, they kind of inspired that in me and my brother. And, you know, we were always out in nature doing things, and that sort of stuck with me. And then a bit later on, there's a guy called Mark Brinson, who's based in the States. And he was the one that came up with this kind of functional approach for wetlands. So dividing the landscape up into these functional units, him and a number of people, but he was particularly important when I was doing my PhD. He was very like generous with his time. And I think his view of kind of that wider view of sustainability, if you like, of how landscape and water work together and what it means, was really key. And yeah, he formed a lot of my sort of ideas and helped shape them. And yeah, that's really, I use it every day. You know, what he came up with, you know, I always kind of start from that and then bring people into it. But yeah, it was a key inspiration to me.
So how did you go about finding him as a mentor almost? Was he someone that you connected with through your studies or?
Now, that's a really good question. So that was through the Society of Wetland Scientists. And actually, I should have mentioned that earlier, that there's a lot of kind of professional, you know, sort of societies or organisations, and I really urge people to join them, because they're a real great way to create a network and get close to sort of people, and people are really generous with their time, I find. So Mark Brinson, I went to the States to present, you know, very early part of my PhD, and I knew he was the guru, and I didn't think he'd even really talk to me, but he happened to be in the session where I presented. And he came up to me afterwards and he said, oh, I've got a field trip where I take people to Italy. I'd like to use some of your ideas and test them out, and then I'll feed them back to you. And I just couldn't believe it. You know, this was this amazing man. And then he just stayed in touch with me. And I would, if I got stuck on something, I just send it across to him and bounce ideas off him. And he was fantastic. You don't always meet people like him, but I think if you join these kind of societies or networks, you know, like in the UK here, the British Ecological Society is a fantastic society in that side, and there's ones for sustainability and others, but it's good to go along to the meetings. You'll meet people, talk to them, and also it's great to find people to collaborate on projects and work with. So yeah, thanks for mentioning that, because it's been a key part of my career. It's made a massive difference to me, I think.
Yeah. And to join those sorts of organisations, do you have to be studying or be a specialist in that field already? Or could you join as someone that's perhaps in their final years of school and is just enthusiastic to learn more? Do you need any skills or experience necessarily?
No, I think so. There's normally two differences. So the first is just the societies. You can join whenever. That's not a problem. Joining sort of, if you want more of like a chartered or professional certification, that is different. Then, you know, that's more sort of as you progress through your career. But in my world, for example, in wetland science, we have the Professional Wetland Scientist Certification Program, and you need a degree and 5 years experience before you can become certified as that. However, there's a wetland professional in training, and that is just with an undergraduate degree. So if you have an undergraduate degree, you can start on that. So you'll find that a lot of the kind of more professional certification programs you can join when you are at university level and then progress through. But the societies and joining NGOs and things like that, you can do straight away. So I'd encourage everyone to find what they're interested in and then try and join, because it's a really great way of meeting people.
So there's something out there for every amateur enthusiast that perhaps yes. wants to progress further.
Yeah.
Fantastic. And I wonder if you've got any takeaway messages perhaps for young people that are interested in pursuing a career within the sustainability field, or any messages perhaps more generally for the public about wetlands, what you would like them to really know and take away from our interview today.
Yeah, so, well, I mean, I hope you've got from what we've discussed in terms of kind of careers and things is get out there, volunteer, join things, follow your passion. Your voice is really, really important. We've seen through people like Greta Thunberg and others, and in the UK, people like Bella Lack, and who are really making a difference in terms of raising the profile of environmental issues, sustainability. So, you know, please keep your passion. Don't lose your passion. I've tried to keep my passion, and keep, you know, fighting for change and join organisations, challenge people. That's really key. And yeah, in general, in wetlands, I think just be aware of them, how important they are. Think in a landscape approach. So we often talk, you know, about river catchments, for example. Think about how it's all connected, because a problem down here is normally a solution up there when it comes to river catchments. And so they're vitally important for our life. We couldn't exist without them. So if you see or you're aware of something being polluted or a wetland being filled in, then challenge people about it. Try and understand what's happening, and don't let people get away with it, because we can't lose any more. I should have said at the start, but the reason why our company is called 35% is because in my lifetime, 35% of the world's wetlands have been destroyed, and we're trying to make sure that that doesn't get any worse. So, yeah.
Brilliant, thank you. And I'll just give you an opportunity. That's all the formal questions finished. But is there anything else you really want to mention that you've thought about as we've been talking that you want to get into the conversation as well?
No, I don't think so. I mean, again, it's really just the trying to encourage people to be aware of these things. And then I suppose the thing is that you can do it in a professional career-wise, but you can also do it on a personal level. You know, when it comes to sustainability, you can make changes yourself. Sometimes it's a bit overwhelming when you look at the world and think of all the challenges that we've got, but it's only going to change through you and then working, you know, with your local community. That's a really key thing. You know, work with people around you, change their opinions, get them to do things better. There's loads of great examples where that's happened. I mean, we used to have CFCs and aerosols, and that was people making a difference, you know, challenging it, and then companies changed. You know, I think people can get a bit like caught up with trying to change government and policy and those sort of things. And whilst that's important, more important is, you know, on a local level and getting companies around you, getting organizations around you, getting your friends and family to change and to do things in a better, more sustainable way. That's a key thing.
Yeah, I think often, as you say, people get overwhelmed with trying to face some of the big challenges and forget the individual differences we can make if everyone's starting to make them. And if you can influence others, actually have a really big bottom up impact, as well as thinking about the top down things that perhaps we haven't got so much influence or control over. Wonderful. Well, thank you ever so much, Matthew, for your time today, for being here with us and for explaining more about the work you've been doing and encouraging us all to get more involved in wetland restoration, conservation, and increasing our knowledge about wetlands as a really important habitat and ecosystem for us. So thank you very much for joining us, and we look forward to further conversations in the future.
Thank you.
This has been Speaking of Sustainability, a podcast by the Trust for Sustainable Living. Thank you very much to today's guest, Matthew Simpson. Episode hosted by Kirsty Shakespeare, organised by Kirsty Shakespeare, music by Billy Painter. Find us online by going to trustforsustainableliving.org and join our online community at tsl.earth. Thank you for listening.